You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in. I don't know about you, but the snow is falling outside my window, and pitchers and catchers report in a little more than a week in Florida and Arizona. Looking forward to that. In the meantime, on this week's AL Central podcast, we're going to talk to all the beat writers from MLB.com and do a little off-season review. It was a busy one in the Central, so a lot to recap. Here we go. Jeffrey, Game 5 was November 1st, and in the 3 or 4 days following that, Ben Zobrist becomes a free agent. Johnny Cueto becomes a free agent. Ryan Matson, Franklin Morales, Chris Young, Alex Gordon, of course, Jeremy Guthrie, and Alex Rios. Now, if I had told you at that moment, you know, first week of November, that the Royals would not only retain Alex Gordon, retain Chris Young, but add the way they have with Ian Kennedy, of course, in the rotation. I think that would have qualified as a pretty surprising series of developments. We knew, obviously, a championship-caliber club wants to rebuild reload. But I think Gordon in particular would have caught us off guard. And then to know that not only are they going to have the wherewithal to bring back Gordon, but to make additional additions on top of that is pretty surprising in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, I really went back and forth on the Gordon thing. I mean, I remember toward the end of the playoffs that, you know, a lot of people were asking me what I thought, and I just kind of kept thinking, you know, as close as Dayton Moore and Alex are, that I just couldn't imagine him being in another uniform. But then when you start looking at the economics of it and how Dayton kept telling us that, you know, the payroll is going to not go up significantly from last year's opening day payroll, and I'm doing the math, and I just couldn't quite picture it. But, you know, sure enough, they made it happen. And you mentioned Chris Young. I think we all knew that one was going to happen right away because he was such a, you know, Dayton called him the MVP of the pitching staff, you know, in the playoffs and maybe even during the regular season too because of his versatility. So that one was kind of a no-brainer. And, you know, the other guys, we pretty much knew they weren't going to, you know, do anything with Cueto, and Zobrist was going to be out of their range, and Guthrie wasn't even on their postseason roster. Rios was, you know, hurt most of the time. And so those things all, you know, didn't surprise us. But and you mentioned Ian Kennedy. That's the one that, you know, surprised us, and that's one we're going to have to keep the closest eye on because that's such an unusual deal for the Royals to make, so uncharacteristic to, you know, commit that much money to a guy who's probably a middle-of-the-rotation guy and to give him three player options. And but, you know, they have maintained that they really want to get more innings out of their starters, and he's a guy who 2 years ago sucked up 199 innings, so they're kind of counting on that.
Well, and you mentioned the way the Kennedy contract is structured, the first 2 years guaranteed, and then it's basically up to the player. But really, that just kind of speaks to just the importance of these next 2 years we talked about before. I mean, the Royals are very much, they're all in on this window of time, this window of opportunity with what has obviously been proven to be a championship-caliber core.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's potentially several guys, you know, Kane, Moustakas, Haas, who could leave after 2017. But, you know, the way this organization is built, you know, by then, it'll be time for some of the younger guys, the Starlings, the Zimmers, the El Montes, maybe even Brett Eibner. Those guys have to come up. You have to keep rebuilding from within. Dayton has said many, many times that, you know, building a team through free agency is a flawed system, and especially for a small market team. So they do have this window where they're going to have the basic core. But, you know, even beyond 2017, you're still going to have Perez. You're going to, you know, have Gordon. You're going to have Ventura and some other guys. And, you know, like I said, that'll be the time that, you know, they'll need their farm system to produce some more starters.
I guess one thing that shouldn't surprise us, Jeffrey, is that they did go after bullpen, you know, reinforcing that bullpen once again, as they did a year ago after coming off the AL pennant. And this time, we all knew Greg Holland was going to be non-tendered given his rising price tag. And, of course, the surgery, they'll keep him out of commission. But bringing in Joaquin Soria in a very thin free agent market, thin enough that, as we saw, Ryan Matson got a 3-year commitment from the A's after missing 3 years prior to 2015. But within that thin market, the Royals are able to sign Joaquin Soria, bring him back into the fold. And again, yeah, it just kind of spoke to just the level of importance they place upon that pen.
Yeah, and that's you know, they targeted Joaquin very early. I think it'll be a nice homecoming for him, and that's, you know, one of the cornerstones of how Dayton builds a team is even when the Royals were pretty lousy in the, from 2007 to 2012, they always had a very strong back end of the bullpen, and that's been a priority since Dayton got here. He just does not want to, even when you're rebuilding, you know, you're not going to get that many leads, and when you do, he wants to make sure you hold on to them. And he's kept that philosophy throughout that, you know, this team is built on the bullpen first, defense next, and starting pitching third. And you know, whatever they get offensively is great. But that bullpen is like I mentioned, one of the cornerstones of the team, or probably the cornerstone. It's going to be that way again this year with the signing of Soria. And interesting, too, as you know, Anthony, a lot of other teams are, you know, taking a look at that model and go, maybe we should start thinking about that because it's much more affordable than going out and spending, you know, $300 million on a starting rotation.
Absolutely. And it's gotten to the point where this doesn't sound weird anymore, but a few years ago it would have sounded weird, teams trying to emulate the Royals. Big market teams like the Yankees trying to emulate the Royals. It's a wild, wonderful world we live in. You know, another thing, Jeffrey, you know, obviously bringing back Gordon was the big move in the outfield. Let's talk about a small one. The Royals signed Travis Snyder to a minor league deal. And, you know, this is a guy a lot of us have been waiting for him to click. He's still, I think he's only 28 years old. So, you know, timeline-wise, there's reason to believe it's still in there. But this is obviously a, you know, a once very well-regarded prospect, first-round draft pick a decade ago. It hasn't clicked for a full season. He's shown some, you know, he's had his moments here and there. What's the outlook for him? And how he fits into this roster.
Well, wouldn't it just be so Royal-like if he just, you know, like you say, clicks with them? I mean, that's just what they do. You know, the scouting department has kept an eye on him through the years. You know, he's number one pick. You mentioned he's had a couple of good half seasons. And, you know, they have a spot, you know, that's, you know, sort of semi-open, if you want to call it that way, with Dyson in right field. We'll kind of do a soft platoon with Orlando, and they'll just have to see what Snyder brings him in the spring. You know, what if he has a breakout spring and just crushes the ball and some scouts think he can. And what if he were just to, you know, grab the spot out there? I mean, it would just be, like I said, so Royal-like to have a guy like that who it's a, you know, very low risk, possibly high reward. That's how they do their business. You know, that's how they got Madsen. You can kind of put Kendrys Morales in that group too. Nobody really wanted him last year, and he busts through and becomes the, you know, Edgar Martinez DH of the year. And that's a real credit to their scouting staff that they take chances on this. You know, there's really nothing to lose with a guy like Snyder
and Rhett. You know, this is a team that obviously, you know, the jump from 70 wins in 2014 to 83 wins in 2015, a lot of fond, fuzzy feelings engendered out of that. And, of course, the hope that they can make a rise now from just above 500 to, you know, legitimate playoff team in 2016. And the way they've gone about that is interesting. I think we went into the offseason, we knew Byung-ho Park was going to be it was kind of fun because we knew there was going to be somebody signed right away, given the schedule for his posting fee in Korea. And I guess my question here is, How surprised were you when you found out the Twins were the team that won that bidding?
I was very surprised at the time. I think more than anything, kind of looking back, the Twins with Miguel Sano, with, you know, the breakout year he had last year as a DH, I thought the Twins were going to try to at least get him in the field a little bit, but I still thought he was going to, you know, kind of split time at DH with Maurer, maybe even Plouffe, and they were just going to kind of rotate, you know, maybe Sano and Plouffe at third base, have those guys kind of DH here and there, even have Sano at first base with Maurer. Kind of play a little bit of corner infield, at least. I didn't think they're going to do anything with Sano too crazy, like movement into the outfield. But sure enough, you know, the news comes out that they, you know, won the posting fee for Byung-ho Park. I remember even when it kind of came out that a team had won, and I thought, oh, okay, you know, Twins, I can't imagine they're going to be one of the teams that really was too serious on Park just because they kind of already had, like you said, some corner infield spots already kind of taken. But sure enough, they won the bidding, and I'm kind of looking back, too, you know, the $12.85 million posting fee, and then the contract they got for him was so team-friendly for only $12 million. It could end up being a steal if this guy becomes, you know, a contributor offensively with that power that he has. As we know, we talked about he had, you know, over 105 home runs combined over the last 2 years. So the power's real. If he can kind of produce that, he's certainly be worth it. So it was kind of one of those things where it surprised me just because they were kind of already set at the, you know, corner infield. And now, as we know, we've talked about Miguel Sano is going to go to right field. So it kind of changes, like, kind of the, you know, complexion of this ball club, kind of mixing and matching and moving guys around. So it surprised me in that sense. I didn't see him as, like, you know, a real fit in that sense. But at the same time, the Twins were looking for power. And like I said, they got him for a really, you know, kind of a team-friendly deal in a sense, once you factor in the fact it was only $12 million for the actual contract itself. So it surprised me, but kind of as we've gotten deeper into the offseason, it's making more and more sense, but kind of still kind of on park to prove that he can kind of see if those stats can translate.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the price of power being what it is, you could see this turning out to be a steal for them, but a lot of that is predicated on him having as smooth a transition as Young Ho Gong. And, you know, a lot of that comes down to how supportive the team is. And the Twins have obviously, early on, they've had Park come out and, you know, take part in their off-season endeavors in the community. And it certainly seems like this is going to be a very welcoming environment for him as far as this big league clubhouse is concerned.
Yeah, definitely. They really have tried, you know, even with the Twins fest, you know, last weekend, or the weekend before last, sorry. He came in, you know, and they had some, you know, Twins employees, you know, at least a couple of Korean phrases, which helped. Try to help him get situated in that sense. And I think, too, spring training will be a big key for him to kind of get to know his teammates and just kind of get used to the higher velocity that he's going to see, that kind of thing. And I think the Twins are going to be, you know, kind of take it slow with him and understand the fact that it's going to be a big transition, not just, you know, baseball-wise, but culture-wise. You know, it's a big shock, I'm sure, coming from Korea to the United States like that. So I think the Pirates are the same kind of thing as we talked about with Gong, and he obviously started off a little bit slow, and then as the season got along, obviously got really hot and became one of their best players, and was, you know, a finalist for the Rookie of the Year award. So I think the Twins would probably kind of like to see a, you know, a blueprint kind of like that, where started him off slow a little bit, and if they have to, I think the Twins would obviously love to keep him out of the minor leagues and let him kind of figure it out at the major league level. But, you know, he does have minor league options if that were to happen, worst case, and they do have some depth that, you know, like we know with Sano and we know with Kenny Vargas, they have some depth at that position at least. But they are trying to, you know, take it easy with them. But at the same time, they have high hopes, and they signed him for a reason. They believe that he can hit, you know, 25-plus home runs right away even. So I think the Twins still have high hopes, but they also want to kind of take it slow and make sure that culturally and just the adjustments to baseball kind of happen smoothly at his own pace, in a sense.
Well, as you said, we were surprised to find the Twins going after a DH, and doubly surprised, I think, to see the bullpen, you know, basically untouched. If you had told me the Twins are going to sign a DH and not to a multi-year contract and not a reliever to a multi-year contract, that would have been a surprise going into the winter. Talk about the bullpen situation and just how that's played out. Obviously, it was a thin free agent market to begin with, so tough to maneuver within that.
Yeah, it's been an interesting, you know, market. Some of the top guys, like the relievers, we've seen get 3- and 4-year deals, and I don't think the Twins were ever that comfortable ever wanting to do that. You know, this is an organization that we talked about has never even given a multi-year deal to a reliever ever in free agency. So I still thought going in there, probably going to sign maybe a lefty reliever to a 2-year deal or maybe even a 3-year deal, you know, maybe someone like a Tony Sipp type. But clearly the Twins weren't really willing to go that route just because I think they know that relievers have a volatile position. You know, one year the guy could be great and have a great season, and the next year all of a sudden he's just, you know, just not there anymore, just doesn't have the great numbers. Just kind of seems like it's a little bit tougher to predict in terms of, you know, how the reliever is going to fare. And sometimes the Twins have been lucky kind of picking guys up, you know, guys like Jared Burton or Casey Seen, kind of guys they picked up on, you know, minor league deals that all of a sudden became big contributors. I mean, even last year, you know, Blaine Boyer was in the bullpen the entire year and it was a minor league deal. So I think the Twins realize that sometimes you can kind of find hidden gems, and especially for a lot cheaper. And more than anything, the Twins have a lot of young, you know, hard-throwing guys in the minor leagues right now that are close to the big leagues. You know, guys like Nick Birdie, guys like Jake Reed, guys like J.P. Chagua, guys like Mason Malatakis. So they have some options, at least in the minors, guys that were in Double-A last year that figured at least be in Triple-A to start out the year and potentially in the bullpen after a month or two. Even Alex Myers, the guy you could kind of put in that category. So they have some hard throwers and some big arms in the minors I guess it just kind of shows they have confidence in those guys. Because clearly they haven't really done much to address the bullpen outside of a couple non-roster invites. Some guys like Fernando Abad's a little intriguing. You know, Dan Runsler, Brandon Kinsler. So some guys that at least have some major league experience. Buddy Boschers, but just not really anybody that really jumps out at you, and nobody on a major league deal. And certainly there's still time they could sign somebody because there are some names still out there, but at this point, I still think it would be more likely that they'd add another guy maybe on another minor league deal rather than sign somebody to a major league deal at this point.
JB, a little bit of news this week. In the bullpen for the Indians, minor league deal for Craig Stammen. He missed basically all of 2015 with a torn right flexor tendon. What's the give me the thought process behind this signing? Does this guy have the stamina to help the bullpen? Thank you. Sorry.
Oh, man. Dad jokes right out of the gate.
Man.
Yeah. You know what? I think this is kind of goes along the lines of the Jabba Chamberlain addition, and they brought in some veteran lefties to look after the bullpen, Gorzolani, Detweiler, Thatcher. You know, and they're just trying to build up a bunch of experience and depth for a bullpen that has a handful of vacancies right now. I mean, I think right now you pencil in Cody Allen, Brian Shaw, Zach McAllister, and Jeff Manship based on what he did last year. Beyond that, it's kind of, you know, wide open. You got some 40-man roster guys in the mix like Kyle Crockett and Dan Natero, who was acquired this winter as well. But, you know, you bring in some guys on minor league deals like this, and, you know, it really boosts that depth. And the Indians have shown over the last few seasons, especially under Terry Francona, that it seems like one or two of these guys always makes the club. And I think that probably makes it attractive for those relievers to come to Cleveland, you know, and feel like they're actually competing for a spot as opposed to just being considered minor league depth. But, you know, I think it's, with Stammen, it makes sense. Yeah, he missed the full season, but he's very effective in the 3 years prior to that, and spent his whole career in the Nationals organization, and you know, has that sinker and slider mix, and can be pretty effective out there in the bullpen. So makes sense as a low-risk, high-reward type deal.
Well, Stammen, he's as good a transition point as any for us to get into our off-season review here, because that's kind of what the off-season has been for the Indians. They have taken some low-risk opportunities here, guys who might be primed for bounce backs or just more sustained success in 2016 than they had in 2015. JP, I was saying to somebody the other day, how old is your daughter now?
Two.
Right. Now, is she into Frozen?
My son was a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. Because my one-year-old is already, like, it's like the one thing to calm her down is Frozen. And there's a song in there, he's a bit of a fixer-upper. You know that one?
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty much, you know, when the Indians sign a guy, even that's what it's been. Guys who are a little bit of a fixer-upper, Stammen included. Of course, the big ads for the offense, Rajay Davis and Mike Napoli. Napoli, of course, came into 2015 having had this complicated, is a nice way of putting it, surgery to cure his sleep apnea. That had to basically break his jaw and get in there and rearrange things. So that sounded uncomfortable. So you could understand why he got off to a bit of a slow start in Boston last year, finished strong in Texas. But those two guys, take them in conjunction. I mean, that was obviously, those are the Indians' two big gifts when it comes to, you know, trying to find new fits here in this offense.
Yeah, and, you know, and for all the fans who want them to go spend $200 million, I mean, let it go, right?
Oh,
we're sticking with the program.
We are on fire today.
Oh, man. You know, you're right. Those are the big additions. I think, you know, big is a loose word being used loosely here. I think it goes to, you know, the Indians believe they have their core group in place. You know, the guys that are going to be their most impactful players are the guys that are young and have been locked up to those, you know, team-friendly extensions, buying out arbitration years and some of their early free agent seasons, and obviously the starting rotation. And, you know, from talking to manager Terry Francona at Tribe Fest when he was here recently, you know, they would have loved to go out and get a big power bat, and, you know, if they had the ability to spend that type of money. But he said the way he would obviously prefer to play would be to keep that rotation together, which they did, which I thought was their biggest move of the offseason. was not trading one of those guys. And, you know, counting on that pitching staff and the improved defense on keeping this team in each and every game, which is going to have to be the formula for this team to win. But, you know, he said he'd rather do it that way than trade from that staff and, you know, try and bring in a guy, and but next thing you know, you're in a lot of slugfests throughout the year, and that's just draining the team in a variety of ways. So, you know, in that regard, when you're taking the whole picture, which is having that realistic view of what the Indians can do financially and also looking at the makeup of their roster, you know, I thought, given all those circumstances, this was a pretty good offseason. I wouldn't say it was an outstanding offseason. I wouldn't say it was a terrible one. I just think they found some holes and they found some guys that, if they're healthy and if they can, you know, live up to the type of platoon splits that they have and do the defense that they've been doing in the past, you know, this has the makeup of a roster that can contend in this division, especially with that pitching staff. So, again, not an offseason that's going to blow anyone out of the water, steal any national headlines. But I thought it was effective in the way that they solved some of their holes and given the makeup of the core that they already had in place.
Well, there are still some corners of the internet where people are still proposing trade ideas involving members of the Indians rotation, and that's just the way it is when you have guys who could help a lot of clubs. But that decision to stick with those guys, how much of that do you think was driven by the way the market played out this winter, the free agent market?
Yeah, I think that played a huge role into it. And, you know, I think you also saw some of the trades that happened, too. Shelby Miller trade, you know, among them, you saw what type of talent exchanged hands and that type of deal. I think when the Indians could see even that trade market, you know, what the asking price was in terms of prospects, that only helped the Indians ask for more in their talks with teams and be willing not to settle for a deal, but say, hey, you know, we're content on sticking with this rotation and contending unless you really blow us out of the water. And I just don't think teams were willing to do that. But yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the fact that the entire rotation, the projected rotation for opening day is going to make right around or a little under $15 million combined, that's pretty impressive when you consider the annual salaries going out to some of these free agents on the open market.
As we are dangerously close to pitchers and catchers reporting in Lakeland, Florida. And Beck, I don't know about you, but I was certainly taken back by the overall scope of the Tigers' offseason. Now, it's easy to say in retrospect, you know, when Mr. I breaks out the wallet, he breaks it out in a big way. We know that. We knew that going in. But there were certainly a lot of indicators, you know, organizationally and the changes made last year to suggest that, well, maybe the Tigers are going about things a little bit of a different way. But obviously they were one of the winner's bigger spenders.
Yeah, they're pretty all-encompassing there. You know, I think it was impressive the way that, you know, Al Avila, first offseason as general manager, had a shopping list. He stuck to it by and large. And then when the authorization came to make a bigger splash there near the end, they were ready for it. And, you know, they were able to get Jordan Zimmermann early, but they still had money later to be able to go after Justin Upton.
Do you think, and this has been pointed out elsewhere, but the money they commit to Upton, as you said, late in the game, late in free agency, do you think there's any argument that it would have been better off you know, addressing various needs earlier in the winter with those resources, or is it just a matter of, you know, certain players are worth that kind of commitment, unexpected though it may be at the time?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what you're looking for. The relief market, if you're looking at that, I think really the better pieces there were available via trade. And the Craig Kimbrell deal, they didn't really have the prospects for something like that.
Right.
Aroldis Chapman, his situation was such a roller coaster. I think if you were going to look at them putting those types of financial resources elsewhere, I think, you know, maybe that would have been an area of priority, but the market didn't play that way.
Right.
You know, could they have gone in on a David Price or maybe a higher-ranked pitcher? Yeah, I mean, they could have tried, but I think the odds were against them. know, even if they gave it a little boost. I think it just, the way the market played out, it just, this was kind of the way it was going, that if they were going to make a major outlay, it was either going to, you know, it was going to be in left field or some sort of outfield spot, or, you know, maybe you spend a little bit more in that setup position and fortify the, or, you know, in the bullpen overall besides closer, and then fortify the bench. So, you know, instead of, say, a Mark Lowe, maybe you go after one of the bigger names. But, again, it's one of those where I think once you got past those top-tier guys, and mind you, we're talking about a market where, you know, you're still looking at guys like Antonio Bastardo still out there and wondering what was going on. Could they have gotten there in O'Day? I mean, maybe, but it depends on, I guess, what the you know, what his preferences would have been. I think all the reports suggested that he wanted to stay close to the East Coast, you know, for his wife's career. I guess the one thing you wonder, and I think we've brought this up before, is if Al had known that they were going to have that money available to go after an Upton or a Cespedes, would they have made the deal for Maven and made the deal for Mike Avilas? And, you know, Al Avilas says that, you know, it was a sudden change, but that even with the change, he still sees a fit there. Yeah, I guess, you know, we'll have to see how center field shakes out, I guess, before really making a full determination on that. But it's certainly a deeper outfield now. Would they have gone after different pieces there to fill out that outfield had they known going in that left field was going to be a bigger outlay?
Yeah, you make a good point about the bullpen in particular, just because it was such a thin market, and so there wasn't a lot of opportunity to even do much lavish spending there early on or late. But, and it's also a great area to throw good money at bad, basically. And it's an area where you
can definitely
find. Thank
goodness knows we've seen that in recent years.
Very much so, yeah. I mean, you look at Mark Lowe. What did he make last year with the Mariners and Blue Jays? He made like $1 million or something. And he gets a two-year, $11 million contract from the Tigers, but he's an example of one of many examples of guys, of teams finding, you know, bargains in the bullpen bin. I kind of like the overall complexion of the Tigers bullpen much more now than previously. I've spoken to a lot of people who really like the Justin Wilson acquisition in particular. Obviously, K-Rod is the big name. But that trade for Justin Wilson, you know, there's a very nice setup presence for them. So what are your thoughts on the bullpen now? It wasn't as big of a splash, obviously, as what they did in the rotation and the outfield, but it was certainly an area they addressed.
Yeah, I think it's one of the more balanced late-inning trios they've had in quite a while. Maybe since the days when, you know, Phil Koch was kind of at his peak form, and you had Joaquin Benoit and Jose Valverde. So you're talking, what, about 5 years ago now, maybe, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
So I think this, from a balanced talent standpoint, you know, this might be better than that trio. So you might even be looking way back to, you know, when they had that Rodney, Zamaya, Todd Jones triumvirate, you know, back in 06. I'm going to be curious to see how it plays out in the seventh and eighth innings. I think what it's done is it's given Brad Ausmus a lot more options than he had, you know, really the last couple of years, as far as how he wants to play matchups and how he wants to go seventh and eighth innings. And he's indicated some flexibility with that, you know, being, you know, maybe on some nights, depending on which spot in the order comes up and whether it's lefties or righties, it could be Mark Lowe seventh and Justin Wilson for the eighth, or it could be flipped around. So they have some options there. You're also able to mix in guys like Blaine Hardy and some of your, I guess, shorter stint guys in smaller doses compared to last year, where it felt like it stretches that Ausmus had to save Alex Wilson for the best situation possible, because he was really the one reliable arm he had for certain stretches. So it's I think this is the year we'll kind of see a little bit more of what Brad Austin's bullpen philosophies really are.
We are going to do a off-season review for the Chicago White Sox. And, boy, you know, there's been some big acquisitions in Chicago this off-season. None bigger than your new glasses.
Well, no, I would say the two TVs I bought after 19 years not buying a TV would still trump the glasses, but glasses run a close second because that was about 10 to 12 years. I'm slowly but surely, you know, remodeling myself here. It only takes me about 2 decades to get moving and start changing things.
It's interesting because your new TV is high def, which you were not accustomed to, but then you go and get the new glasses. You would think you would have needed the high def, the better picture before your new glasses. I struggle to understand Scott Merkin acquisition process, but I do understand what the White Sox are trying to do. They're trying to compete in 2016. The central thesis of going into the winter was, I don't know if thesis is the right word. I shouldn't have said thesis. I said the central question is, will they or won't they? Will they go for it again after getting burned in 2015, or will they kind of retool a little bit? But they're definitely going for it, Merck. And first of all, just your grand takeaways from that decision and what it's wrought here so far.
Well, I think it's a good offseason overall. I know there would be plenty of people out there, because I talk to them frequently on Twitter and see their comments, that think it was kind of done in half measure because they haven't got that last bat that people want. You know, they didn't get either of the three quote-unquote big-ticket free agents, although I think two were going to be pretty hard to attain no matter what you did, in Gordon and Cespedes.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I've said this ad nauseum at this point, Frazier is one of the bigger offseason pickups for any team, not just the White Sox. And that's no offense to Saladino and Olt, who played there last year, but I just think he is the first really solid, you know, kind of daily third baseman you can count on, really, since the Joe Creedy days. You know, and people, Frank Thomas even mentioned Joe Creedy and Robin Ventura. He went back that far. So, you know, I know Todd didn't have a tremendous second half of the season, but I also know the Reds were well out of contention at that point. So that might have had a little something to do with it, but I think he's going to be a huge lift. And, you know, everyone you talk to, just a great guy in the clubhouse. And really, because of the fact that he's such a power-packed hitter, you know, I think overlooked that he's a good defensive player and a pretty good athlete who can steal some bases and hit, too. So that's a nice addition, and I think Brett Laurie is a great addition. You know, just that edge he brings that you hear about is something the Sox were missing a little bit last year. And again, I think, you know, they changed focus a little bit behind the plate, going a little more offensive-minded, although both guys are, you know, good handler pitchers, too. So we'll see what happens. And I don't think they're completely done yet, and I don't know if that means it's going to happen, you know, right after we hang up from this podcast, or if it's going to happen in mid-March at spring training. But I still think Rick Hahn is looking at it. As you've written about and many other people have written about, there's a lot of good players still available out there.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think there's 70 or so free agents, as we sit here today, in the second week of February now. And obviously not all those guys are going to command guaranteed contracts. Most of them will have to settle for a minor league deal. The White Sox, as we said before, Mark, they're still in a good position, having you know, two picks in the first round, having one of those picks protected. You know, they're the team a lot of people point to as one that could still do something with one of those remaining position players tied to the compensation draft pick. But as far as what has been accomplished, yeah, the Laurie and the Todd Frazier trade, the Frazier trade in particular, dealing from the system the way they did. I mean, Frankie Montas is, of course, a player a lot of people like. Trace Thompson, you know, really had a strong showing in his first call-up to the big leagues in 2015. And it was interesting to me, Merck, that the Dodgers basically valued that package of players, and Micah Johnson included, over their own guys, Jose Peraza and Scott Schebler, who they send to Cincinnati. So a complicated trade in that regard, but just from the White Sox perspective, going that route for Frazier, how risky is that to give up a player, especially of Montas's caliber, in a trade like that?
Well, I think one of the problems is, you know, their system is getting better. I mean, by leaps and bounds, where it was a few years ago, because it was, you know, probably one of the worst in baseball a few years ago. And now, you know, much more depth, better players at the top. But I think when you trade away three guys who are in your top 30 there, you know, you're taking a risk, so but you have to give up something to get someone as good as Todd Frazier. You know, I think a lot of people are looking at Montas because Montas has kind of the skill that jumps out the 100-mile-an-hour fastball. But while some people think the Sox traded high on Trace Thompson and Robin turned a good job of using him primarily against lefties, I think Trace can be a solid player. I think Trace gets it. Trace comes from a highly accomplished athletic family. For the few who don't know, you know, Michael Thompson, his dad, won championships with Showtime, the Lakers. Klay Thompson, one of the best shooters in the NBA, won a title with the Warriors. Other brother Michael also has played professional basketball. Trace just gets it. And I think some of these guys, this is one of the things that I have talked about a little bit about, obviously, Alex Garcia. Sometimes it just takes certain players longer to really hit that level. And when they hit that level, they're off and running. And Trace, it took a few more years in the minors to get to the right spot where he needed to be. But he was great last year. And don't forget, he was the best defensive outfielder they had in the system. And I like Micah Johnson, too. I think Micah fell victim to the fact that the team was awful defensively at the start of last year, and he was not strong defensively at that point. So they had to do something, and that was the easiest move to make, is bring Carlos Sanchez, a better defender, in a second. But, again, it's a move they had to make. They needed Todd Frazier as part of this, you know, this ongoing revamping process that Rick Hahn has talked about. And they didn't give up any of their top, you know, quote-unquote three they did. Montas was, at that point, one of the top three. But they still were able to keep Anderson, Fulmer, and Spencer Adams in there. So, again, I don't know if it's a risky move, but I think it's kind of a calculated risk they had to take because of the fact of who they got back.
One surprise, Mark, we didn't know for sure if they would address the catching position at all, and especially in light of needs elsewhere in the lineup, and yet it was the thing they went after first, was to change their look behind the plate. And I think that was really the first signal that, okay, this team's making an earnest effort to improve for 2016 and not just stand pat, but letting Tyler Flowers go, and against Chris Sale's wishes, I'm sure, but bringing in Alex Avila and Diner Navarro. Talk about that change behind the plate.
Well, it sounded like there was a possibility at one point that Tyler could have stayed and been, you know, kind of the Chris Sale and Carlos Rodon kind of catcher, and because he had a great rapport with both those guys. I mean, he caught every pitch Chris Sale has thrown in the last 2 years, and Rodon thrived, you know, with Tyler back there last year, but ended up being a good situation for both guys. You know, Tyler, I think, kind of needed to move on. He's got a good chance in Atlanta to play regularly with his old battery mate, old catching mate, A.J. Pierzynski. And the Sox just felt like, you know, they had a bigger impact by adding better bats, maybe not quite the pitch framing that Tyler had, but still, you know, pretty good defensive guys back there, and Navarro and Avila. So, and, you know, Chris Sale is fine with that. I mean, Chris is a competitive kid, but he's also the ultimate team-first guy, so I think once he realized, okay, got over the fact Tyler was gone, that's it. I'm not going to have this guy further. He embraced the challenge to, all right, let's get something going with the, you know, start figuring out something with the new guys. And I know he's talked to both of them quite a bit in the off season already, and they're looking forward to the 19th to get things going. So again, this one, you know, Rick has kind of gone at this methodically, not trying to do everything in one off season. You know, last year he kind of fixed the bullpen, and they still had a few hiccups here and there, but what bullpen doesn't? Much better than the year before because they had guys in spots now. They had guys in their roles, starting with David Robertson as the guy who was going to be the closer, barring a trade for, you know, 4 straight years. And now they went after the offense this year. That was the focus of this off season: improve a very weak offense from last year, and they have definitely done that with those four acquisitions we talked about.